Thank you, thank you, thank you. That was wonderful. We're going to do a short story of all for all ages, which means that this is for kids and adults. And so I invite the kids to share first, since we often get to hear from the adults. If the kids don't want to, then the adults are welcome to answer. So who knows what's happening on the calendar this week? Something is changing. Something outside. Emily. Fall. Fall. Do you know the fancy name for fall? That's a nice one, too, but I'm thinking something else. Equinox, right? Equinox. Equa, equa, equa. What other words? Equal? Any other equa words? Equitable? What? I'm afraid to ask. Fort Knox, thank you. Equilibrium. Right, all of these mean kind of balance, even, the same amount on either side. Why would we be calling fall the fall equinox? Does anybody know from like their science classes? Why is that? What is equal happening next week? Aiden?
It's the equal time of day and night.
Equal time of light and dark, day and night. Right.
It's going to be exactly equal.
Right. It's equal. It's a changing of the seasons. What can we see? What's your senses? What can we see that's going to change?
The leaves.
The leaves. What are the leaves going to do?
They're going to change color.
They're going to change color. What kind of colors are we going to get? Brown. Yeah. But there will always be brown. But yeah. But what are some of the fun colors? Well, I shouldn't say that. Brown's a beautiful. Carotene, now that's an interesting color.
Orange,
yes, yes. Yellow, yes, yes. You know the interesting thing about these colors? They're not happening so much as they're being revealed. They were always there underneath the green. So it's kind of an interesting thing for us as Unitarians to think that there are all these layers and all these colors inside us, just like the leaves. What are some of the things that we're going to feel that are going to be different?
Pain.
Yeah, I suppose I'm going to, yeah, that happens. Like Karen. What are some of the things that are going to feel different when we're outside now? Are we going to have to dress differently, Emily? It's going to get colder, because what's coming next after fall? What? Holiday season, yes, fall. Allergy season. Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, I guess that's part of it too. So it's going to start getting colder. We're going to have to start wearing our clothes, the more clothes than we have been. What are some of the things that we're going to be able to taste that are different? What kind of foods are going to come out now? Squash. What?
Fruit.
Well, yeah, that's right. What fruit in particular around here? This to apples. Anybody go apple picking? Yeah, apple picking is a lot of fun, and that's a perfect fall activity. My favorite coming around this time of year is corn. Sweet corn. What season?
Cider season.
Cider season. Yeah, a cider donut season. Oh, my gosh. Yeah, we're talking a lot of fun. So, and what kind of holidays are coming up in this next season? We've got two that I can think of. Emily? Halloween and Thanksgiving. You got them both. Twofer. And Thanksgiving makes me think of the harvest, of the apples, and also of like a great basket of all the different things that are the bounty, the things that are brought in and we're so grateful for, and they get us through the cold that's coming up. Now, AUU, who is an artist, created what she calls her basket, her bounty basket. And for those of us who know about drawing and the fun with art, coloring something like this in can be a lot of fun as an expression, as a way of feeling better, as a way of creating beauty. So I've left a few of these in the nursery for any kids who will be leaving us and would like to, leaving us right now, not big time, but would like to do some coloring during the rest of the service. And if there are any left afterwards, I welcome the adults to take some home because they're a lot of fun. And if you look very carefully in this, you'll be able to find a chalice. to kind of, ooh, hidden pictures. All right. We're going to sing the children out into the hallway. They'll get a little tour of the building. They'll get a little tour of the grounds. They'll get a chance to talk about what we do here. And so let us sing our song for getting them, letting them out, which is Go Now in Peace. I've forgotten what the number is in the book, but we'll start. Go now in peace, go now in peace. Parents are welcome to go with their kids. Love's around, I'm everywhere, everywhere you may go. Go now in peace, go now in peace. May the spirit of love surround you everywhere, everywhere you may go. Welcome everyone this morning. This is our annual historical UU service. Unitarian Universalists may not have saints, but we do have famous members whose names we may have been known to drop. A search online will bring up recent names like the actor Paul Newman, Joanne Woodward, and Christopher Reeve, writers Rod Serling from The Twilight Zone, Ray Bradbury, and Kurt Vonnegut, singers like Pete Seeger, Holly Neer, and Cher. And architect Frank Lloyd Wright. Go back further in time when Unitarians and Universalists were two separate faiths, and we have Unitarian presidents, Thomas Jefferson, John Adams, John Quincy Adams, and William Howard Taft, authors Louisa May Alcott and Ralph Waldo Emerson, and that midnight writer, Paul Revere, as well as Universalists, Clara Barton, Horace Greeley, and George Pullman. We are excited this morning to welcome some prominent figures from the past that we have claimed, rightly or wrongly, as UUs. We have asked them here to speak to us about the lives they led and the beliefs that guided them as a way to both honor them and educate themselves, ourselves. This Living UU History is being presented by a gallant group of volunteers who will be bringing these legends briefly to life. The words come from this book, Credo, which is Latin for I believe, and it's a collection of imagined statements of belief from 37 historic Universalists and Unitarians. This book was written by a congregant of, I believe, a San Diego congregation, which regularly had a credo as part of their weekly service. Any member of the congregation would prepare a very brief statement of faith. So that inspired him, like, I wonder if, John Adams were still alive, what would he say? So he created this book, and anyone who's familiar with publishing knows that there's usually a page in the front that says all rights reserved. Well, you should know that the front of this book says no rights reserved, because he believes that knowledge and information belong to the entire human family. And it says you are authorized to reproduce the contents of this book in any form or means of your choosing with no further permission from the author. Obviously a UU. I would offer to our volunteers, I can go first just because I'd love to sit down and listen to the rest of you, or if anyone is really eager to come on up and be their person, they could do that. Okay, I guess I'm doing mine. Since when I spoke to Lee last week, I was saying there's not too many women and there's certainly not too many women of color, and she goes, what are we limited? You know, so I'm going to be Howard Taft. Thank you very much. Yes, yeah, well, okay. Let me just see where he is. Here he is. I'll have to get my orator voice on too. Good morning. I am William Howard Taft. I was the sixth Unitarian elected to the presidency of the United States. Those preceding me in the office were John Adams, Thomas Jefferson, John Quincy Adams, Millard Fillmore, and Chester Arthur. You may know that I also was at various times a lawyer in Cincinnati, judge of the Superior Court of Ohio,
Solicitor General of the United States, the first civil governor of the Philippines, Secretary of War, and Chief Justice of the United States. You may not know that in the years between my presidency and my appointment to the Supreme Court, I served as president of the American Unitarian Association. Unitarianism was an important part of my life. Let me give you two illustrations. From the time I was 8 until I was 15, my father was a judge of the Superior Court. A Catholic group petitioned the Cincinnati School Board to ban the use of the King James, that is, Protestant, Bible in public school classrooms. A Protestant group filed suit to prohibit the board from acting on this request. You understand, of course, that in Ohio in those days, most Protestants were Republicans and most Catholics were Democrats. Two of the three judges hearing the case ruled that the board could not end religious instruction or prohibit the use of the Protestant Bible. My father, both Republican and Unitarian, felt the law was clearly on the side of separation of church and state. He filed a dissenting minority opinion. The Ohio Supreme Court subsequently upheld his view and overturned the majority ruling. Our entire family was attacked as ungodly, immoral, atheistic. Father was accused of being a traitor both to the Republican Party and to his social class. It mattered little that the Tafts were faithful churchgoers, seldom missing a service at our Unitarian Church. The protesting Protestants never forgave him. His promising political career was severely damaged. Still, he told me many times that he never regretted his decision and considered it one of the most important of his judicial career. 40 years later, in 1899, the Yale Corporation offered me the presidency of Yale, my alma mater. I refused their offer, primarily because of my religious affiliation. Quote, "Yale's strongest support," I reminded them, "comes from among those who believe in the creed of the Orthodox evangelical churches. I am a Unitarian. I believe in God. I do not believe in the divinity of Christ, and there are many other postulates of the Orthodox creed to which I cannot subscribe. The election to the presidency of the university of such a one would shock the large conservative element of those who gave Yale her power and influence in the country. Fortunately for me, my political opponents never got their hands on that private letter. If they had, I can assure you that William Jennings Bryant, rather than William Howard Taft, would have been elected the 27th President of the United States. My term as President of the American Unitarian Association coincided with a period of ascendancy of the social gospel. This put me in conflict with many of my fellow Unitarians. My own conservative convictions, earnestly arrived at through vigorous self-searching, were very different from those held by persons such as the Reverend Dr. John Hayes Holmes of New York's Church of the Messiah. In 1908, the same year I was elected to President of the United States, Holmes had been leading figures in the creation of the Unitarian Fellowship for Social Justice. This agency reflected the views of many who, like Holmes, were socialists and pacifists and strong supporters of organized labor. At the General Assembly of the Unitarian Association in 1917, a resolution was passed supporting President Wilson and the American war effort. Holmes and his followers sought to add a rider to the resolution, indicating there was a strong minority objection to it. I left the chair as presiding officer and spoke vigorously in opposition to the addition. The assembly sided with me. I may have been right on these issues, or I might have been wrong. Who is to say for certain? What is important, it seems to me, is that the fundamental Unitarian tenet of freedom of thought and freedom of speech was not compromised. If my experience teaches me nothing else, it at least proves one does not have to be politically liberal to be a Unitarian. Thank you, Mr. Taft. That was so nice of you to come by today. All right, I know we have a couple other wonderful notable people. Yes, is that Florence? No, I'm sorry, that was Louisa. Louisa, please welcome Ms. Louisa May Alcott.
Thank you. If you have read Little Women, as I suspect you have, you know my story. Meg was my older sister, Anna. Beth was my younger sister, Lizzie. Amy was the baby of the family, my little sister, Abby May. And Joe, that was me. I'm Joe Marge. A writer is supposed to write about what she knows, and what I knew best was my family. Everything I believe and hold dear is embraced in the pages of that book. I was born in Germantown, Pennsylvania in 1832. My father was the philosopher Amos Bronson Alcott. Along with Ralph Waldo Emerson and Henry David Thoreau, my father was associated with a group of idealistic intellectuals called Transcendentalists. Father organized a school in Boston based on very progressive principles of education. He believed that a child's divine nature could be awakened by dialogue between teacher and pupil. He taught in that wise way which develops what lies in a child's nature, much as a flower blooms, rather than stuffing the child with more than it could contain, like a Strasbourg goose. He believed that question and answer sessions could unfold truths and insights already within the child. He also introduced sex education at his Temple School and enrolled a black student, which was too much for Boston, and angry parents shut the school down. So he moved to Concord to start over again. Father was a tender man. He was, of course, my model for Mr. March. He loved to play with my sisters and me. Every night he told us stories. He encouraged us to make up stories of our own and praised us highly when we did so. His early urging that I write poetry and plays and keep a daily journal surely had much to do with my latter success as a writer. Yet my father was not a practical man in the marketplace. He dreamed great dreams, saw them fail one after another, but never stopped dreaming. When I was 10 years old, my father and another one of his Unitarian friends, Charles Lane, organized an experimental farm community named Fruitland. They believed in the possibility of human perfectibility and felt it could be achieved through self-discipline and self-sacrifice. Fruitland was to be the place where this belief about human potential could be realized. The farm would provide the communal environment where people could live and work together in harmony, peace, and love. We lived there with a number of families, and it offered many good experiences, but it was a difficult and Spartan existence. We ate no meat, for the community believed it was wrong to take the life of another creature. We only wore rough linen clothing because it would have been wrong to even take the woolen coat from a sheep or cotton, which was a product of the exploitation of slaves. The Fruitland experiment failed after only 3 years, and the family moved back to a house in Concord given to us by Ralph Waldo Emerson. It was this experience that set my goal in life, to help my family from their life of poverty. In the following years, I taught school, worked as a domestic, and during the Civil War, I served as an Army nurse. Hospital Sketches, written at that time, was my first published work. No matter what else demanded my time, there were two things I did every day. One of them was to write something, anything. But every day I wrote. The second was to run in the woods. I had done this from my earliest childhood and continued to do it as long as my body allowed. When I was 37, the first section of Little Women was published, with part two appearing the following year. From that moment on, we never again suffered financial problems. I was able to provide a comfortable life for my beloved family. So that is my story. What does this have to do with my credo, my statement of personal beliefs? I know that I was a Unitarian, though not necessarily the churchy kind. Like my father and William Ellery Channing, I believed deeply that every human being was made in the image of God, just as our family's dearest friend, Waldo Emerson, believed. I felt that God was not to be found in creeds, dogmas, or miracles, but rather in the deepest recesses of the human heart. Through David Henry Thoreau, who often took me with him on long walks in the woods, I found divinity in nature. I once wrote in my journal of an early morning run in the woods. The dew was on the grass, the moss was like velvet, and as I ran under the arches of yellow and red leaves, which are coming up soon, I sang for joy. My heart was so light, and the world was so beautiful. It seemed like going through a dark life or a grave into heaven beyond. A very strange and solemn feeling came over me as I stood there, with no sound but the rustle of the pines, no one near me, and the sun so glorious as if for me alone. I seemed to feel God as I never had before. I prayed that I might keep that happy sense of nearness all my life.
Thank you, Louisa, and thank you, Ingrid. Next, we have Miss Dorothea Dix. Would you please give her a warm welcome?
Dorothea Dix wears glasses. Good morning. I am Dorothea Dix. I was born in the year 1802 in a hut on an isolated farm near Hampton, Maine. My parents had been sent there by my grandfather, who owned huge tracts of land in the region. He, for some reason, thought that they could work out problems in their marriage in that bleak and stark environment. Rather, it drove my father to drink and to religious fanaticism, and my mother to chronic invalidism. Mine was not a happy childhood. At 12, I ran away to live with an older sister in Worcester, Massachusetts. One of my cousins liked the stories I told and said I would make a good teacher. So, at age 14, I opened my own school for younger children. At 18, I moved to Boston to live with my grandmother. I also began to attend church with her. It was the Unitarian Church where Dr. William Ellery Channing was the minister. His influence guided me throughout the rest of my life. The plight of poor children on the streets of Boston caused me great pain. I asked my grandmother for permission to use the hayloft in her carriage house as a school for those impoverished ones. She resisted, but I persisted. At last she said, "Have your school for beggars then." So, in addition to my regular teaching position, I opened a second school. Dr. Channing and his family spent their summers at a home in Rhode Island, overlooking Narragansett Bay. For several years, they took me along as a governess for their daughters. There is no way I can tell you what an inspiration it was to spend those intimate times with such a family. After 15 years of teaching, I suffered a nervous and physical collapse. Dr. Channing arranged for me to go to England and be cared for by his friend, Dr. William Rathbone. And for 18 months, he and his wife nursed me back to health. More than that, they adopted me into their circle of friends, which included Samuel Tuke. He was the builder of the Retreat of York, the first modern mental hospital in the world, where mentally ill patients were given books to read and music to enjoy. He told me of the terrible conditions of the insane in many parts of England, where they were imprisoned in dungeons, chained to posts, thrown food as if they were animals, and often put on display for a fee. I could not believe what I was hearing. While I was in England, my grandmother died, leaving me a legacy which provided enough for me to live on. I returned to Boston, determined to find out if treatment of the insane differed in my own country. What I quickly discovered was that the deranged, the paupers, and the violent criminals were all thrown together in the same prisons. All were considered demon-possessed, and perverted jailers seemed to think themselves to be the instruments to punish those evildoers. I took my findings to Dr. Channing, who put me in touch with three of his influential friends, politician Charles Sumner, educator Horace Mann, and physician Dr. Samuel Gridley Howe. I explained to them that I was sure that the conditions I had found in Boston were probably true throughout Massachusetts, and that the legislature should take action on this problem. They responded that someone would have to visit the jails and almshouses of the state and document the true conditions. That, they said, would take both considerable time and considerable money. I told them I would undertake that survey myself. And I did. 18 months later, Dr. Howe presented my report to the legislature. It documented my findings of horror. A woman in Dedham who seemed quite sane, chained in a dark stall behind the almshouse. No one could recall how long she had been there or why she was there at all. In Medford, a man kept in a stall for 17 years. At Shelburne, an old naked man with his feet frozen off, but the stumps in chains. And on and on and on. 2 years later, the Massachusetts legislature voted funds to build a new special hospital for the insane at Worcester. That was the first of 123 asylums and hospitals which were built through my efforts over the next 3 decades. I traveled more than 30,000 miles from Canada to the Gulf of Mexico, from the Atlantic to the Mississippi, observing the treatment of the insane and proposing new and humane methods of care. It was fascinating to observe the gradual change of attitude. Shortly after I began my study of conditions in New Jersey, a resolution was passed in the legislature providing $1,000 to, quote, get Miss Dix across the Delaware River and out of the state. 3 years later, they appropriated funds to build a hospital, which became a model for the nation. During the Civil War, I was appointed supervisor of nurses for the Union Army. For 4 long years, without a single furlough, I pursued that assignment. It was so demanding that I almost lost the self-control which I had so carefully cultivated over the years. After that, I went back to New Jersey to spend my remaining years in a suite they provided for me in that magnificent hospital.
Thank you, Ms. Dix, and thank you, Lee Flint Smith. All right, George stepped up first. That's okay. All right. So we are welcoming Albert Schweitzer, yes?
You can call me Al. Okay. I was born in 1875 in the little village of Kasselburg, which at the time was part of Germany. Yet, I was an infant. My father, a Lutheran pastor, was called to minister to the Church of Gunzburg, France. It was there that I grew up. As a boy, my first love was music. I was, I suppose, what would be called a child prodigy. When I was only 8, with legs that would barely touch the pedals, I began to play the organ for services in the Gunzburg Church. By my late teens, I was dividing my time between the University of Strasbourg, where I was studying theology, and Paris, where the famous organist and composer Charles Marie Widder had taken me on as a student and prodigy. I accepted my responsibilities of preaching and teaching at St. Nicholas Church, Strasbourg, and began to perform organ concerts in Paris and elsewhere. One day I picked up a magazine published by the Paris Missionary Society and read an article entitled "The Needs of the Congo Mission." By the time I finished reading that article, the course of my future life was determined. I would go to the French Equatorial Africa and practice medicine there. I enrolled in medical school and spent the next 3 years studying, making a specialty in tropical diseases. On Easter Sunday, 1913, I played the great organ at St. Sulpice for the last time. When I finished, the Paris Bach Society presented me with the piano filled with organ pedals, packed in a lead-fine case to withstand the tropical climate of Africa. Their precious gift accompanied my bride Helene and me to Lamborn, located in what is now Gabon. The core of my faith is summed up in the phrase, reverence for life. It continues today in a different form. I had long struggled with the problem of man's cruelty to his fellow man. And one day I observed four hippopotami and their young on a sandbank of the river, seeing how these huge yet humble hippos cared for their young was my answer. The reason people are so cruel to one another was because they did not care. Only by nurturing reverence for life could we treat others and all living things as we ought. That simple insight became my key to unlocking the mysteries of life. Now, let me say a few words about my relationship with the Unitarians. Even as a theological student, I had great admiration for the early Unitarians and their affirmation of religious freedom, even when it meant persecution. Also, there was much in the way we addressed matters such as the Trinity and the divinity of Jesus that drew us close. Once, in the immediate aftermath of World War II, my hospital was heavily in debt and threatened with closure. At that very moment, Dr. Charles Joy of the Unitarian Service Committee in America and Mr. Melvin Arnold, the editor-in-chief of your Beacon Press, arrived in Lamborghini with a check which more than covered our indebtedness and allowed our hospital to continue. In sequential years, Melvin Arnold probably did more than anyone else to make my work known as widely in America as it was in Europe. So my respect and gratitude to the Unitarians is warm and well-placed. Then, in 1961, my 86th year, I received a letter from George Marshall, the minister of the Church of the Larger Fellowship, again, that being part of the Unitarian Universalists, in Boston, asking if I would accept honorary membership in his congregation. I wrote back immediately, thanking him for the honor. My letter was reprinted in the newsletter for religious liberals, and many people thought I had rejected my lifelong Lutheranism to become a Unitarian. A minor uproar erupted on both sides of the Atlantic. Finally, I had to clarify the matter by telling Time magazine that while my relations with the Unitarians were meaningful and strong, I had not made the break for the Unitarian Church. So there I leave you to decide whether or not I was ever Unitarian. Either way, I'm happy. And a couple of quotes. You know, it's interesting. Now I'm George again. Step there. You know, I've been involved in amical advocacy for many long years, and we have used his quotes without really thinking they were from Albert Schweitzer. And here we are, a full circle. So I'd like to read a couple of quotes from Albert Schweitzer just that are meaningful for me, and I think also with some Unitarian people who have expanded their compassion. We must fight against the spirit of unconscious cruelty with which we treat animals. Animals suffer as much as we do. True Humanity does not allow us to impose such sufferings on them. It is our duty to make the whole world recognize it. Until we extend our circle of compassion to all living things, humanity will not find peace. And there is one more that... Where is it? The thinking man must oppose all cruel customs, no matter how deeply rooted in tradition or surrounded by a halo. We need a boundless ethic which will also include the animal. And one more. We must never permit the voice of humanity within us to be silenced. It is man's sympathy with all creatures that first makes him truly a man. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Albert Schweitzer, and also George Coniglio, for bringing him to life. And I think we come to our final, greatest, best, Ms. Jane Addams.
Good morning. Buenos dias. I am Jane Addams, and that was my Spanish class for the day. Okay. For nearly 50 years, from 1889 to 1935, I was the director of Hull House on Halsted Street in Chicago. This settlement house, as it was called, was the fulfillment of a childhood dream, though it took me quite a while to make the connection. I was born in Western Illinois in 1860, the year Abraham Lincoln was elected president. My father was the wealthiest man in our village of Cedarville and in nearby Freeport. He owned a flour mill, a sawmill, was president of the local bank, and a respected member of the state senate. He was a longtime friend of Lincoln and a leading member among the group of state politicians which organized the Republican Party. One of my cherished possessions was a portfolio of letters Lincoln wrote to father, all addressed Dear Double D Adams, in reference to the rather unusual spelling of our last name. My mother died in childbirth 2 years after I was born, and father did not remarry until I was 10. So he was my anchor in early life. Once, when I was 8 or 9, he took me with him in our horse-drawn carriage to a section of Freeport I had never seen before. The houses were small and crowded and dilapidated. I was shocked, not having ever seen such poverty before. I suppose I had assumed that everyone enjoyed the kind of luxurious comfort with which we were blessed. On the way home, I told my father, "When I grow up, I want to live in a big house, but I want it to be close to the houses where the poor people live so I can invite them over to visit me." Then, for all practical purposes, I forgot about my vision for 2 decades. I grew up and attended Rockford Seminary, then enrolled in the Women's Medical School in Philadelphia. I completed 1 year of medical studies before health problems forced me to leave school and return home. I had been born with a curvature of the spine. In Philadelphia, this problem worsened and an operation became necessary. I required more than 6 months of bed rest to recover. My doctor counseled me to forget my idea of becoming a physician and recommended instead that I take my rather sizable inheritance and travel in Europe. For several years, I traveled back and forth across the Atlantic numerous times, but I was not happy. I once wrote in my journal, "I am tired of living and would gladly choose death, except that I believe it to be cowardly to die before one has done something worthwhile." I found that something worthwhile at Toynbee Hall, a settlement house founded by an English clergyman in London's miserable East End. I remembered then what I had once told my father. In 1888, I returned to America, moved to Chicago, and began my search for the big house near the little houses. I found it right in the middle of the tenements on Halsted Street, the very center of Chicago's foreign immigrant quarter. Gracious old Hull House, built 40 years earlier, had been abandoned by the Hull family when immigrants began to arrive. It now stood nearly empty, used only as a factory storehouse. It was perfect for my needs. I found the owners, explained what I intended for the house, and they deeded it to me free of charge, happy to no longer have to pay the taxes. I spent my own money renovating and redecorating the house. It was not my intention to live in poverty. Rather, it was my intention to help them rise out of poverty and live in the comfort I enjoyed. If that seems strange to you, I can only say that it is a truthful testimony of my intent. I was not a martyr or a saint. I created a place of beauty and invited others to sample it. We provided daycare for working mothers, a medical clinic for those who were denied access to private physicians, recreation programs for young people, preschool education for children, a job resource center. Whatever the need, we sought to provide relief. Mostly, we strove to promote the kingdom of God on earth by improving working conditions, building better housing and sewage systems, getting pure water and sanitary facilities, parks and playgrounds, and eventually eliminating poverty. Toward that end, for 7 years, I personally rose at 6 a.m. every weekday and followed the city garbage wagon through our neighborhood, making sure it did the job it was supposed to do. Yes, in the beginning, we did believe that we were engaged in a Christian missionary enterprise, but we never held religious services at the house. That would not have been appropriate for the people we were seeking to serve. During those years when I went to church at all, it was to the Unitarian All Souls Church, where Jenkin Lloyd Jones was the prophetic leader. I guess that makes me a Unitarian, though I don't believe I ever officially joined. Later in my life, I became a convinced agnostic. But that didn't seem to bother the Unitarians, who were pretty much the same. Giving other human beings the opportunity to enrich and elevate themselves was what Hull House was about, and that was enough for me.
Thank you, Jane Addams, and thank you, Carol Ellis. I think someone snitched my... We have a very brief time where we could have some congregational sharing. Can someone who has the order of service let me know if we do the hymn before or after? Before. I wanted to do this hymn because this was written by a former Fourth U person, and it is about the Fourth U, and it's always been kind of near to my heart because of that, although I know it's a little sappy. So let us get the hymn done. And actually, we're not probably going to have time for congregational sharing today. I'm sorry. We've just had so many interesting guests and things to do. My thanks to all of our wonderful volunteers. I did not mean to say that Carol was the last and best. I mean, Carol's my best friend, but they were all wonderful. So one more round of applause for our volunteers.
Since you don't know this, I could sing it through once and you guys could sing afterwards. You want to try that, or you want to go line by line? Once through. Yeah, it's getting ready. I'll sing once, and then you come in and sing the first verse again with me. Go forth, O forth society, whose Unitarians, as free and kindred seekers, in fellowship join hands. Go forth with chalice burning bright, with fellow keepers of the light, toward truth, toward peace and harmony, with wonders unsuppressed. Go forth, O forth society, our answer is the quest.
Right, you ready to try?
Yeah.
All right, do the best you can.
Go forth, O forth society.